Hello and welcome to the Koi Sports CIC Grassroots Podcast, linking business with grassroots sport. My name's David Waldridge, and in each episode, I'll be speaking with a business leader, inspirational person, or true self-starter about themselves, their career, and passion for all things grassroots sport. This is a special episode taken from one of our recent Elite Champion networking events, where those who support our mission to bring positive social change through grassroots sports have the chance to hear from former and current inspiring sporting athletes as they share their stories from how they started at a grassroots level through to the heights they achieved within their particular sport. We were joined by former WBC light heavyweight boxing champion of the world, John Conte, as he shared some inspiring stories, his views on boxing in general, mental health, and how to achieve a champion mindset. We're incredibly proud to have John Conte as part of the Koi Sports CIC Grassroots Podcast.
Well, I turned pro in 71, and I won the title in 3 years. But that's the way my personality was. Give it everything, like sprint really fast, do it as much as you can, as quick as you can. Other people, a different mentality, they can go on longer, slower, they may hit the top at a not so quick. Everyone's different.
As you said, within 3 years, you turned pro and you were the world champion in such a short period of time, winning the Commonwealth title at 19 as well, 25 wins to your name. When you were at the top of the world, would you say that you were still learning at that stage and that discipline to get to that level? Did that come from that grassroots original training?
So when I was a kid, as a schoolboy, I didn't do much as a schoolboy or as a junior. And it wasn't until I was defeated in the junior ABA championships in 1968 in Basildon. And I got stopped inside the distance, you know. But I came back and I thought, well, could I have done anything better? Could I have trained harder? Yeah. I didn't commit myself to it totally. And I thought, well, if I'm going to continue with this game, I better commit myself to it totally. Give it everything I've got. Number one, that was the big fuel or the big decision in my mind. And I believe in God, you know, still do. I believe God helps them and helps themselves. So we heard that if I help myself 100%, he'll help me. And after that, when I came as a senior, different game altogether then, with that in mind. And the same when I came pro.
So you were one of 10 children, I believe, to lace up the gloves. What made you go from the streets of Kirkby to that level so quickly? I mean, I know that once you were there, you achieved everything in a rapid period of time. But that original journey, you mentioned that hunger. Would you say that was a key element behind everything?
Yeah, making mistakes, you know, and learning from them inside and outside the house. Let's put it that way, you know, and the crossroads and just looking back and learning from them. And I seem to be quick to learn from them and then put myself onto the straight track. And with that mentality of what I said before about God helps them, helps themselves. I'm talking about my own belief system here. And that was it. That was great for me. Once I chose a boxing, and it was boxing, that was where I had an ability as well, a natural ability since I was 11, it seemed to be. And I thought, well, but I hadn't committed myself to it till I was 18. Like I said, once I turned as a senior.
Now, you featured on cards with one of the greatest of all time, Muhammad Ali, who once even called you too pretty. And now he convinced you to take up light heavyweight when you originally wanted to go down the heavyweight route. Just how much of an effect did that man have on your career?
Well, he should have seen me before I started boxing when I was in Liverpool. I was all over the place. But so I took up boxing and seemed to get knocked straight. So when he said, you're pretty, I said, you should have seen me in Kirby. But he was just fantastic. He was not my idol. Joe Lewis was my idol. But Muhammad Ali was the greatest. I think he beat them all. I think a great boxer will beat a great fighter 8 out of 10, because a great boxer is a great fighter. Just that they've got more tools in the back. And Muhammad Ali was the greatest, I believe. And I boxed twice on his bill, Croke Park, Dublin in 72. And then in 73 in Las Vegas, when he fought Joe Bugner, I was on the undercard. And he just gave me some good advice. You know, I was in the ring one day and I said, hey, Muhammad, could you give me some? I was campaigning as a heavyweight then. My first 20 fights were heavyweights. And I said, hey, Muhammad, could you give me some advice, please? He says, yeah, get out my division. So I dropped down to light heavy. He was true as well, because I wasn't big enough to be a heavyweight. The most I was a cruiserweight, but there was no cruiser then. Light heavy was called cruiser, which is 12 and a half stone maximum. Anything after that was officially heavyweight. Now you've got a cruiserweight division the last 20 odd years. You've had it for 30 years between 12 and a half and 13-10, I think it is, 13-12, which would have suited me as well.
Well, something I was going to touch upon later, I was going to ask, what in your mind are the main differences from boxing today to the boxers of your generation? Because boxing always seems defined on eras. You have the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, and then today. What for you is the main differences from when you were at the top of your game to now the guys that are at the top?
I can't really say, you know, I'd have to leave that to people like yourselves or technical people to understand that. But it's the same people who are doing it. So as a young leader, I can only give you my experience, giving it 100%. Whatever's in front of you, it's just the same for the other fella. It's just another human being in your era. So whatever you've got to do, you do. You know, you've got the control over that, how much you apply yourself and dedicate yourself to get doing your business and hopefully getting a win. And even then, you can still lose, but it's not because you haven't given 100%. And from that, you'll get great knowledge. It'll help you to move forward.
So you got the MBE next to your name back in 2017. For you, would you say that was the crowning achievement for your whole career?
Absolutely. It's two different things. You know, when I was champion at Wembley, 74, couldn't believe it. 3 years since I retired. God helps them, who helps themselves. The next thing, I'm up there. And it happened, I had to pinch myself when I was the champion, you know, when he raised my hand. But I couldn't believe myself, like, you know. So, and then to come out into the, you know, the big world, the main arena, and then to be awarded such a fantastic accolade from Her Majesty, you know, which was just incredible. And I was at Windsor Castle. And that was great when I was there, because they did tell me to say ma'am and don't say mom. They said ma'am when you respond, yes, ma'am. Not mom. I always thought it was mom.
Obviously, you switched the boxing ring for the golf course these days. Do you still find that discipline and what you learned from a grassroots level managed to switch over to a new enjoyable sport in retirement?
Well, it's the toughest game. Toughest game. I feel like golf's a completely different game because it's just you. Nothing moves. Just you. You're totally responsible in the most beautiful areas. Beautiful clothes you're walking around in. Beautiful green, you know. This little ball, nothing moves. The ball's not moving. You're totally responsible for everything. And I'm always screaming at the ball, come on, fight fair, move, bob, weave, do something. So I can handle something moving, something still. Fantastic game. But once you hit a good shot, it's great. I'm involved in a lot of different charities as well. Great people who are involved in the game, business people and that, who are involved, that raise a lot of money for the charities we're involved in.
A lot of people were kind of warm to you back in the 70s because you came across as a normal personality. Was that something that was always important to you to stay that guy from Liverpool, despite all the success you were having?
Well, I think that's where I got a bit of it. I got an equity card as well because I was involved in acting. And I think that was because I can cover it up. You know, all come across as an humble person. Very nice, down's a weird. But inside, you want to be king. I think the king can suss it out, though, who's the ones that have to lose throw. But give it the best you can. Just try and be yourself. And which is not easy for me because you're always driving, you're driving. I think that sort of insecurity or whatever it is, less than or is pushes you forward. And it's all useful. It's great because it's on the right vehicle. But and then I've got insights into that, you know, it's just human, isn't it? And dealing with it.
Michael asking, who was your toughest ever opponent?
My toughest ever opponent? There was loads of them. There was Chris Finnegan, who won the European title off and the British Gumball titles. And there was Saeed Mohammed, second fight. Well, the first fight was hard, 15 rounds. I got stopped in four rounds, five rounds in second fight in, with against them, 1980. But the 79, the 15-round fights, that was hard. Alvaro Lopez in Copenhagen defending the title. That was hard, 15-round points decision. Yeah, There was a world championship fight. I say Chris Finnegan. He was a great fighter, tough lad. 15 rounds against George Amada. Empire Pool Wembley, now the Wembley Arena.
Do the memories of that night still go through your mind on a daily basis?
Not really, not a daily basis, but maybe every 7 days, because that's when you can remember it. Again. But nowhere. It's just good. It's all nice, and it goes so quick. You look, the older you get, the quicker it seems to go time. And it's like, that was 1974.
Nick was asking, if you have any other family members and any other generations within the Conte family who have took up boxing, have you helped guide them in their careers now?
No, they all done a bit. There was 10 in our family, 8 boys. I mean, all done a bit. KB Amateur Boxing Club with Charles Atkinson was the guy who owned it. And he won the George Cross for bravery in the Second World War. And for dismantling mines. Landmines, that's what he was doing in the Second World War. Then he started putting them together again in Kirby, the mines, the landmines, us, his kids. But put with the boxing. And Tucker Edmondson and Tommy Singleton. These were great trainers and managers. Put me on the road. And we all done a bit at Kirby ABC, all the 8 boys. But I was the one that totally committed myself to it. And they were good. There was one in particular, one of my brothers, would have been better than me. No, he just didn't fancy it. And he'd done a bit. He was okay, had a few fights, but didn't commit myself. I think it's that mental decision somewhere along the line in your head to say, I'm going to totally give this everything now.
So those early days of boxing, you mentioned you boxed against the RAF. Was that pretty tough for you, or was that kind of easy in those original ranks?
Well, it was funny because we was in the RAF. I don't know how I got in the RAF, but I think there were some people who were involved in the amateur boxing who were involved with the RAF. And that's where my first stadium, gymnasium, was the RAF Fazakerley. That was Kirby Amateur Boxing Club, which was about a mile or two outside of Kirby. It was an old disused RAF camp. And that's where I first started boxing when I was 11. And then we came about 2 or 3 years later, we got our own gymnasium at the Kirby, new brand new gym, at the Kirby Athletic Stadium, you know. And then we moved there. But I was in the RAF. And we were in their championships. I remember boxing in their championships. And I didn't think it was too difficult, not being arrogant, but simply because those lads seemed to be committed to the RAF. They were told at the time, they were totally committed, anything to do with the military. They were totally committed to that first, and boxing sort of come set. It's different. It was different after that. I don't know, for the last 40 years or 50 years, maybe. It's been different. Totally committed then into the boxing, and that's what they study. Stay in the military, but it's boxing that comes first, and they end up as Olympic champions and all that. But no, that was good. The RAF, ATC, the Air Training Corps.
Now, when you were boxing in the RAF and you went to the Commonwealth Games as well, did you set yourself a target to become world champion, or was it just a natural progression?
Once I committed myself, whatever it got me, took it one fight at a time. Whatever how far I was going to get. And I gave myself like 3 years when I turned pro. 3-4 years, totally give it everything, see how far I go. But within those 3 or 4 years, totally everything, you know, every day, eat, sleep and drink it, 24 hours a day, although you're only training twice a day. But it was a 24-hour day, eat, sleep and drink it, and see how far I'd go. So that was my mentality. And at the end of 3 years, I won the titles, you know, along the way.
We'll head back to the legendary John Conte in just a few moments. If you're interested in becoming an elite champion with Koi Sports and benefiting from networking opportunities, business promotion and investing in a grassroots organisation, then find out more on our website, koisports.co.uk. Now let's return to the conversation with John Conte on the Koi Sports CIC Grassroots Podcast. So another question from our elite champions asking, how did you cope with retirement from a mental health perspective and having to leave boxing and find a new career, a new path to go down?
I found that difficult, you know. Didn't know really. I think you made the decision with the boxing, totally committed, as what I've just said. You're totally committed to that. Then you come out, you'd really have to do the same thing. Identify, recognise and choose a vehicle you're going to totally commit yourself to. And that was a very difficult, like, you know. And I found that difficult. And then the idea for me was really just to get stuck into the drink, the booze, you know. I just got stuck into the booze, really.
Would you say that was because there was an absence from dedicating so much of your time and so much of yourself towards boxing that as soon as that went, there was almost a void?
No, I think it was simply because I was an alcoholic, which is what I am. I'm an alcoholic, you know. So I suffered from alcoholism. That's what it was. So all those other things, all the underlying things about reasons, what you just said there, David, sure, they have influences to it. But the bottom line is, I was an alcoholic. I had to take the drink. I crossed the line and I became, you know, I was compelled mentally, a mental obsession to take the first drink. Then a physical allergy, which once I crossed the line physically, without not metabolizing it 1 ounce an hour, after I crossed that line, where I used to metabolize it, if it stays in there longer than 1 ounce an hour, it physically craves another one. The enzymes don't metabolize it. 1 ounce an hour. If it does that, you don't get drunk. The only time you see normal people drunk is that they choose to get drunk, as I used to before I crossed the line. So one was too many, 100 wasn't enough, but it was the obsession to take the first one that did the damage. They said hay fever sufferers don't have an obsession to sniff flowers.
So it almost became the biggest battle of your career was against the alcoholism at that stage.
That was it, yeah. In 1982, I was in a clinic, King's Road, Chelsea. 72, 73, being treated for alcoholism. And I remember I was across the psychiatrist there. I said, I'm an alcoholic, doctor. He just looked at me and said, yeah. I came out of there 3 weeks later and had a drink to get over it. I went to an association who had been dealing with this, these issues, and they sorted me out. And since 19, I hit rock bottom, 1989, after 5.5 years in the association trying to sort myself out. 2.5 years without a drink, but I kept taking the drink. But 1989, coming through withdrawal, I got it. And I haven't had a drink one day at a time since then.
Well, good for you. Congratulations, John, for being clean for so long. An amazing achievement. I suppose that's another world title in itself in some cases. We'll open some more questions on the floor. Thoughts on the likes of Holyfield, who stepped up from cruiserweight to take on the likes of Tyson? Was that something you were ever tempted to do to eventually move up to heavyweight? I mean, I know you originally started that way and then moved down to light heavyweight, but once Muhammad Ali had finished, were you ready to almost jump up to this division, or were you always happy where you were?
No, I was never heavyweight. So I never had any illusions becoming a heavyweight. You've got to have the power. It's not the size. Some are 6'9" or 6'7", some are 5'10". Tyson, how tall was Tyson? 5'9". Was he at the most? But it's not the size, it's the power they've got. You've got to have that punching power. And I didn't have that. I didn't know. You know, I wasn't big enough of, you know, the power of that. So it's not just the size, it's the power. It's the power of punching. So no. I could punch you. I was a good puncher. I could punch my weight as a light heavyweight, but not as a heavyweight.
Do you think that unorthodox style of your boxing helped you at that level of boxing in terms of staying light heavyweight as well?
Oh well, whatever weight I was, the style, like I said earlier, I believe a great boxer will be a great fighter, 8 out of 10, because a great boxer is a great fighter. Got to have it all. You see, Muhammad Ali had the lot, the chin, the courage, the heart, you know, but you've got to fight the fighter. When you're fighting a great fighter in front of the ring, he's going to get you, no matter how a great boxer you are, he's going to cut the ring down and get you right in front of him. And you've got to be able to punch your way with him. And if he's still there, I'm talking about Muhammad Ali mainly now. He moves away and he's got other tools, whereas the pure fighter, he's got only one way to go, in your chest. You don't have to look for him. He's there all the time. The great fighter, Joe Frazier, he beat the great boxer, you know, Muhammad Ali, the first time, you know. And all the Tysons, the Sugar Ray, the Marcianos, all these great pure fighters. I say 8 out of 10 off the top of my head, you know. But certainly less, they would be the less. But those less ones, like, they are great. You know, they would be the ones that would be beat the great boxer, you know. But 8 out of 10, a great boxer will beat the great fighter.
So I'm keen to get your thoughts on the modern day boxing, especially how now it's become beyond just the boxer fighting in the ring, beyond the person that's got the gloves on. It's almost become about their managers and their promoters as well. I'm just keen to get your thoughts on that compared to what it was like back in your day.
Yeah, I suppose there's much more. I don't know where. I was going to say razzmatazz, it's probably business, you know, especially with the television, which you video all over the world, where you screen all over the world. At one time, it was just in front of the television. At one time, it was just on the radio, you know. And even before that, there was no radio. It was just in a field. So it's advances and advancements and advancements and advancements, you know. So when television came in and they could view it all around the world, then the business people are going to exploit, use their talents to exploit all that. So I take it, it's all necessary. So the fights that we were talking, boxing in this case, so the bottom line, what you're selling is boxing, you know, the boxer, the fighter, to the public, they want to see the fight. But the business of it is like more, obviously more complicated, but not to the business people, not to the people who know what they're doing. You know? As far as the boxer's concerned, how he deals with that, that's up to them individually.
Michael's keen to get your thoughts on comebacks in regards to the likes at the moment of Tyson making a comeback, Fury, he's in the midst of making his comeback as well. Your thoughts in general on an athlete making that comeback to the stage?
I always say I'd come back if I could go back to 23. It's a young man's game. Very difficult. Some can do it longer than others. You know, George Foreman, he went on. Muhammad Ali went on a long time. The recent lads, I don't follow it that close. Floyd Mayweather. For me, like I say, it's a young thing. Give it everything you've got then. You get your money, get into your family, you'll look after your family then, you know. And they don't want you getting damaged and all that. And in the long run, the longer you fight, you may not even show up until you retire. It starts affecting you. So you got to be careful. It's your decision. Not knocking against it. It's your decision. You're all grown up people and you make a decision. It's great that the vehicle's there, number one. Number two, you've got to call the shots on when you get out at the right time.
As someone that dedicated their life to boxing, I know that Mike Tyson said one of the reasons he came back is that the hunger never leaves you. Would you say deep down somewhere that's the same for you as well?
Left me as soon as I got out of Kirby. Now, hang on. Now, listen, I'm not knocking Kirby. It could be anywhere. Could have been Buckingham Palace. The same people that got hunger there. The hunger is a human hunger. The hunger for whatever you want to be. I take it. I'm not sure you'd all agree. Whether you want to be the Prime Minister, whether you want to be whatever. It's there within you, your ambition, your talents, and you want to, the hunger's there, you know. Personally, just for me, yeah, it's there. But it's like anything. Anything can be there. As long as I'm alive, these things will be there. It's what I do with them when they come up. How am I dealing with it, you know? And why? I've got to put the effort, the hard work into it and go, well, why? I'm the CEO of this limited company, life, you know? Why am I? What is it? How's it going to affect me? I've got to start putting the head work or the hard work into understanding why, what am I doing? And maybe take advice or listen to people who are about the same issue, you know? Say, listen, I feel like doing this or doing this. What do you think? Which is not easy again, because you got to, you know, if you're used to doing it yourself, it's hard to sort of reach out, you know, and say, by the way, what do you think? Where business people take it, they're the same. They're used to doing that, committees and one thing and another. Certainly society seems to be run well that way by open debate, you know.
Another question from the floor from Kai. Really like this one. Do you feel that the Olympics or Commonwealth Games have a positive impact on the future of boxing, or does it offer the potential for a false sense of achievement?
I think if you let yourself think that way, yes, I'd say yes. And if you don't let yourself think that way, no. What you do with it, you got the talent. It's how far you want to go with it yourself, and put, you know what you're going into. So from three rounds, when I was a three-round amateur fighter, you know you're going into 15, potentially 15-round fights. Can you do it? What is it? Understanding it. Well, it's just another game. The other fella from the opposite corner. It's the same for them. It's just the same for them. It's just another human being in that business. So are you prepared to put your effort in 100%? You've got the decision over that. Applying yourself, preparing yourself for that game. You've got the yes or no to that. You're the referee of that. And then as far as then, when you go in on the night to compete, let's see how far you get, you know. And most of the times, in my case anyway, I won.
So a couple more questions for you, John. Peter's keen to get your thoughts on exhibition fights that we seem to be getting at the moment. So, for example, where Conor McGregor went against Floyd Mayweather. It's a trend that really is dividing the boxing community. What are your thoughts on these exhibition fights?
Well, they're just different disciplines, just different games altogether. You know, within the same game, it's fighting, you know. Mm. How far do you want to take the game of fighting? How far up do you want to go? What do you actually want out of it yourself? Why are you doing it? What talents you've got, natural talents and abilities, and what mind you have to do what you want to do. What's your mind, you know? Yeah. So whatever it is, if it's a sociably accepted vehicle, then you've got the options and the choice to go on to it. Fantastic, number one, to, you know, to put your abilities on that and drive forward and put all your mind in. Your life on that vehicle. So it's great to have the choice.
So, John, are there any modern fighters that you would have liked to have got in the ring with at your peak? The likes of Tony Bell, you, maybe David Haye. Is there anyone in particular that you wish you could have fought, or are you happy with everything you achieved?
No, I'm in face of the other fighters, no. Because to me, it's just a fight on the night of the fight. It's to fight the guy in front of you. That's it. It's the way I was training for, and you're in. Then on the next one, the next tour, the next issue, the next whatever it is, or the next fighter in my case, you're going into. As far as looking back and thinking, well, I want to fight him, or should have fought him, or could have. For me personally, I'm not speaking for anyone else. I'm just speaking for me. Yeah, no, I'd rather make friends with him now. especially if you've got a lot more money than those sex fighters. stay friends with them, especially when they're young and rich.
So finally, John, before you leave us, once again, thank you so much for speaking tonight. How important was it, those starting out moments in that boxing gym in Kirby and all those kind of grassroots coaches that really projected you and started you on your boxing career? How important have they been, not only in your career, but in your life as well?
Everything, because my overview is I believe in God. So it's everything from down from there. So my overview is the people who help me, human beings, you know, helping another human being. So that's what the turn that started in the way with my parents, obviously. But the business we've been talking about, with the community I was involved in, from there, the seed. He developed you, helped you along the way.
That's it for this special episode. Thank you to our charity partner, Sports Trader. Make sure to find out more about the incredible work they do with young people at sportstrader.com. And of course, thank you to the legendary John Conte for his time and for joining us on the Koi Sports CIC Grassroots Podcast. Make sure to download and subscribe so you don't miss any of our future episodes. Thanks for listening, and we'll hear more from the business and grassroots sporting community next time.